That then covers the ideology, or perhaps we ought to say the lack of ideology, among the nobiliar magnates resisting the French crown during the Fronde. I'd now like to turn to the actual practical political considerations informing this revolt. And I think here again we can say that if any subversive potential which this princely revolt might have had was short-circuited by the nature of their ideology or the lack thereof, this effect was still further reinforced by the practical realities of power on the ground. One of the most striking features of the Fronde of the Princes is the actual relative stability of the crown. Despite all of its financial shenanigans in 1634 and again in 1642, indeed, despite its partial bankruptcy in the year 1648, the fiscal system of the French crown was actually able to survive the strain imposed on it at least long enough to keep the government afloat so that it could prevail. There's a sense in which the financiers who had invested in the system had just poured too much capital into it to let it collapse. They might have been angry at the way they were treated by the crown, they may have felt cheated, but they had poured their capital into the machinery and they could not let the machinery collapse. As a result of this, and there's a certain irony here, Cardinal Mazarin was actually able to borrow repeatedly, despite the virtual collapse of the tax farming system. There's a sense, it's a bit like the argument that if you owe the bank $1 million and you can't pay, you're in trouble, but if you owe the bank $1 billion and you can't pay, the bank is in trouble. It's the same kind of problem. These financiers are too invested in the system to be able to pull out. By contrast, Condé had no such financial resources. He had enormous difficulty in raising taxes from the local population, which was resentful of the bad behavior of his army, and Condé therefore remained heavily dependent upon backing from the Spanish crown, which, as we've seen before, was in fiscal straits of its own. A further weakness in the magnate's position, and I think this is equally striking, is a real marked decline, at least by comparison with the previous century, by comparison with the French Wars of Religion in the later 16th century, in the ability of the magnates to pull in provincial clients, and their ability to raise the provincial elites behind them in the revolt against the crown. Now, there were a whole series of reasons which explain the inability of the magnates to mobilize provincial support. In the first place, the massive sale of venal offices by the crown had in effect made the king, courtesy of the long-suffering peasantry, which had to pay for the whole system, the predominant source of patronage in France. There was no one who was a more important or more generous patron than the French king for all of his problems. Moreover, since the 1590s, the crown had had a policy of destroying rural fortresses. These are the same kinds of fortresses which during the Wars of Religion had sustained rebels in their outposts in the countryside. The crown recognized the problem which these rogue fortresses represented and from the end of the 16th century began systematically destroying them so that nobles didn't have a place to hide in the countryside after they caused trouble. Moreover, and perhaps most striking of all, the great nobles themselves had ultimately begun to turn their backs on their provincial roots. They were drawn by the allure of the royal court, and there's almost a sense of moths drawn to the flame here. Just to give you some figures, of 39 provincial governors appointed between 1605 and 1650, only six of them, that is to say, only 15% of these governors, actually spent any extended period of time in their own provinces. Of the governors appointed between 1627 and 1650, we know that at least two-thirds of them died in Paris, where the action was. The governors built nice houses, they rode around in nice carriages, they attended the court, they went to all the artistic productions patronized by the monarchy, they invested in offices, they invested in tax farms, they invested in loans to the crown. In some, there's a sense in which for all nobles, whether they were big nobles or they were small nobles, important or minor, by the middle of the 17th century, it just wasn't profitable. It just wasn't profitable in every sense of the word, material and ideological. It wasn't profitable to resist the state. It was much more profitable to join the state. And that, it seems to me, explains another part of the reason why the crown was ultimately able to prevail. Well, having analyzed the discontents of a privileged few, the judges, the nobles, we now turn to the grievances of the disenfranchised many, that is to say, the rural masses, the peasantry, who made up the overwhelming bulk of the French population. Beginning in the 1630s, peasant revolts became almost endemic in the French countryside, especially in the southwest of France, that is to say, especially in the regions of Guienne, Gascony, and Quercy.